This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, cultivating resilience, empowering host resistance, prioritizing primary prevention. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander. I welcome you to another short clip exploring Neijing Now.
Lori, it's great to be talking to you. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's good to hear from you again after such a long time.
Lori, can you tell us about your involvement with the International Ban on Asbestos Secretariat?
Sure, I've resided. I began studying asbestos issues more than 20 years ago and eventually decided to start something called the British Asbestos Newsletter, which was called BAN. It became very clear to me that the problem was not just a British problem. Working with colleagues from around the world, we decided what we needed was an international secretariat that would try and coordinate action and spread information, whereby the asbestos industry, which has always been very well organized and conducted their propaganda campaigns on a multinational level, well, we decided it was time that we would fight them on their own territory, and we decided to start the International Ban Asbestos Secretariat, IBAS.
Well, congratulations for your role in getting asbestos banned in the UK. That happened in 1999, you said, right?
That's right. That was really pivotal. And although I'd like to take credit for the fact that the EU did eventually ban asbestos, I would really have to give the credit to our French colleagues. It was the French ban that made the transition inevitable in Europe, because once France banned asbestos, it meant that there were more EU member states with bans than without bans, and that actually sort of pushed, you know, the EU to banning asbestos after the EU announced that they were going to be initiating an asbestos ban directive. The UK government followed suit. So I would have to say that, you know, our French colleagues really should have the credit for that one.
Excellent. But the backlash that the French ban elicited was probably also pivotal in bringing attention to it.
Oh my God, that was enormous. The Canadians had always relied on the French asbestos industry to dominate the European asbestos agenda. And when the situation was revealed in its full horror, because the French researchers documented the asbestos epidemic in France, the French government realized they could not continue, and they said that they were going to ban asbestos, at which point the Canadian government decided to bring a case at the World Trade Organization against the French government for banning asbestos. They felt it was treason, that the French government was behaving dishonorably. You know, how dare they want to protect their citizens and damage the Canadian export market? And so, as you know, the case that the Canadians brought at the WTO went on for many years, and eventually they lost, and they lost the appeal, and that was it. It meant that no longer could the Canadian government intimidate national governments abroad and make them be afraid to ban asbestos, because the World Trade Organization agreed that countries have the right to protect their citizens. So that was a huge victory.
That was, definitely. And even though the ban on asbestos has taken effect, people still are suffering from the asbestos that they had been exposed to. I mean, I've seen estimates in the UK that the cumulative death toll from asbestos starting from the 1930s until 2020 may range up to 800,000 people.
Oh, I would totally believe that. You're right in saying that even in countries that have banned asbestos, we have huge problems. People are still dying in their thousands from the exposures that they had and from the exposures which are continuing. Because, of course, even though we've banned asbestos in the EU, and I have to say the United States has not banned asbestos, we still have asbestos in the buildings, in our infrastructure, in our transport. It is still a killer, and unfortunately it will continue to do so until we get rid of it from, you know, our national infrastructures.
The other contributing factor is that you may be exposed to asbestos in the year 1999 when asbestos was banned in the UK, but you may not develop symptoms of your disease until 15, 20, 30, 40 years later.
That's right.
So because of the lag time, you can still expect to see people getting sick from asbestos for decades after the ban takes effect.
Well, that's right. In fact, I came across something which was amazing. A colleague in Korea told me that Hyundai Steel, one of the biggest steelmakers in Korea, was using crushed serpentine rock in the steelmaking process, which is quite normal. The unfortunate thing is that this serpentine rock contains significant amounts of asbestos fiber. 5,000 people in the factory were being exposed to asbestos. Point being, no one would have known about this had the Ban Asbestos Network of Korea, BANCO, done these tests. It seems unfortunate that with government cutbacks and trade union cutbacks, these sorts of programs are the ones that suffer, and as a consequence, more people will get ill. You know, it's tragic that even though so much is known about asbestos, that people will still be exposed. That asbestos is what you would call naturally occurring asbestos because it's in the rock. And in most of the countries where you have bans, the majority of them don't ban that. I mean, how do you ban something that's natural? So the ban would be for products where asbestos is intentionally added. So, for example, if you put asbestos into a mixture and it becomes asbestos cement, that's banned, right? Or you put it into friction materials or brake linings, that's banned. There are 55 national bans, and what we really need to do is document the specific language in each of the bans, get it translated so we can see exactly where we are with each one.
The point you make is very pertinent about the wording of the bans, because the use of asbestos is very different than the mining or export of asbestos.
Absolutely, but I have to say, you know, the United States hasn't banned asbestos. The industry, the asbestos lobby, or I call them the global asbestos mafia, uses this as part of their propaganda. They say, well, the United States hasn't banned it. If they don't need do it, why do you need to? And of course, it's a shame. In the 1980s, the Environmental Protection Agency actually was on the road to banning asbestos. This so incensed the asbestos industry that they brought a court case about it. So you had the Canadian Asbestos Institute and the Quebec asbestos industry. In 1991, the ban was rejected on technical considerations, and that's 20 years ago. You would have thought that you guys would have been able to get your act together.
Shame on us, absolutely. I think that there's actually a common perception amongst the public that asbestos is banned, but in actuality, you are absolutely correct. The EPA had issued a ban on it in 1989, and then that was overturned in 1991. And so the final decision was that there were five products that remained banned. The rest says that you can continue to use asbestos in products that have historically contained asbestos, but you cannot use it in new uses of asbestos, in my opinion. It's not a ban.
We need to get our act together.
Exactly. Well, the United States was the Canadians' largest market for asbestos, and now I think they're at about half of their peak. It's not as minimal as the public may perceive. Despite what the propaganda may say, it's shocking that anybody would believe that asbestos is safe. It's not. There's no form of asbestos that is safe.
It's a shame, too, because the people who live in the asbestos mining regions in Canada have been fed this propaganda for so long that, you know, they say it's okay to live in this town, chrysotile doesn't damage you, and needless to say, the civil servants and the epidemiologists in Quebec say that the asbestos-related deaths in the mining regions are amongst the worst in the world. So the civil servants know the truth, the epidemiologists in Quebec know the truth, and now all of civil society in Quebec, they too know the truth.
Well, the Canadian government should be very, very concerned about that, because if you're dealing with such high rates of asbestos-related disease and you have a National Health Service, then you better be concerned about how many people you're caring for.
Why do you think there's no mesothelioma register in Canada? Most developed countries make some attempt to track these diseases, but they don't do so in Canada, and that's not an oversight. It's sad. Wouldn't it make sense to decontaminate the mining region where there are huge mountains of asbestos tailings? For every ton of asbestos fiber you sell, you mine, I think it's about 199 tons of ore. You've got these huge mountains, and they contain anywhere between 6 to 12% of asbestos fiber. And they're just there. You can drive in amongst these mountains of asbestos tailings, and when it's windy, the tailings blow into the town and the town is contaminated? And wouldn't it make sense to decontaminate the town to help them generate new industry and new economies?
It's very, very short-sighted.
Especially since the Prime Minister's residence in Ottawa is totally riddled with asbestos, and they're spending lots of money taking it out not only of the House of Commons on Parliament Hill, but of his house as well. You know, it's safe enough for, you know, Indian workers and Filipino housewives and other people, but not safe enough for Prime Minister or the Canadian members of Parliament. It doesn't stack up, and it's not meant to.
Well, the asbestos industry is very strong. They are somehow getting their way, even with major international organizations. I mean, it's taken WHO and ILO till 2006 to issue statements supporting a ban on asbestos, and we still can't get asbestos on the Rotterdam Convention on the prior informed consent procedures for hazardous materials.
But the thing is, they really have shot themselves in the foot. There's negotiation now between the EU and Canada for something called the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, and we called on MEPs to block it until the Rotterdam Convention issue was resolved. You know, we want to make sure that this asbestos issue is on the agenda. And another thing, you know, if you are older than a certain age, you will remember, as I do, all the advertisements that said smoking was good for you. 80% of doctors recommend smoking Marlboro Lights or something. That only stopped because the WHO implemented something called the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco.
Right.
Well, we want a WHO Framework Convention on Asbestos Control.
Fantastic.
I've been to ILO meetings, and the asbestos industry was there. Now, if you go to WHO meetings, the tobacco industry isn't there anymore because people know tobacco kills you. And the same thing about asbestos.
It's amazing that industry is allowed at all, any industry.
That's right. But when I was at the ILO meeting in Seoul in 2008, the biggest exhibition booth was the one with the chrysotile asbestos industry from Russia.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they had a lot of very nice literature that was in Russian, in English, in Korean, expensive paper, very shiny, all about how safe asbestos is.
As a physician, it's hard for me to believe that anybody believes that asbestos is safe. What's the presence of the medical community in these meetings?
Well, there were doctors from Russia, and they said that, you know, nobody has died from asbestos in Russia.
What? I don't know. It's hard for me to understand.
Absolutely. But what is exciting is that, you know, there are grassroots groups in Russia. Can you imagine how brave these people are to take on the might of the Russian asbestos industry? Someone proposed a ban on the use of asbestos in certain friction materials in Russia. Well, the industry got so incensed that they started pressurizing the Ministry of Health. And when the Collegium Ramazzini, these eminent doctors, got wind of this, they took it upon themselves to write a letter to the Ministry of Health praising the foresight of the ministers for trying to get this ban on friction materials through. But as you know, friction materials are extremely hazardous because they have an incredibly high level of asbestos fiber content, you know.
Right.
And I mean, that would be terrific as a first step.
Well, it seems to me that to really make progress on getting asbestos banned internationally, we're going to have to somehow cut the ties between industry and governments. It seems that, you know, even the case of India, they're giving tax cuts to asbestos producers. They're importing asbestos by heaps and mounds. I mean, every year they import 10% more.
We did a book a couple of years ago called India's Asbestos Time Bomb. India has used over 7 million tons of asbestos.
That's incredible.
Well, it's true. The UK asbestos epidemic was caused by 6 million tons. But what is heartening is the grassroots movement. And there was a recent incident where this asbestos cement company was planning to build a new factory in this village. Two teenagers had studied asbestos in school or heard about it, and they knew that this was bad stuff, and these teenagers led demonstrations. It was just amazing. You know, you've got to be hopeful when you see young people engaging with the process.
Well, it's going to have to be the people who do it, because the industry and the government don't seem like they're going to really make rational decisions in this arena.
Well, no, and it was really interesting to try and get a grip on the actual nexus that exists in India between the politicians, the industry, the representatives, the businessmen, and so on. You get an understanding of how powerful this network is of vested interests.
The convenient thing is that the Indian government is actually not collecting data on occupational illnesses. They managed to collect data on occupational fatalities that are fairly obvious, like you fall off a scaffolding and die, or you get crushed in a machinery. Those deaths are hard to ignore, but they're actually not currently collecting any data on occupational illnesses. As far as I understand, they're not even recognizing mesothelioma as an occupational illness.
Well, that's right. Between the years of 1985 and 2005, the Tata Memorial Hospital had diagnosed 107 cases.
Well, that's incredible because it's actually a very, very rare cancer. Mesothelioma does not really arise without exposure to asbestos. I mean, once you've made the diagnosis, you need to link it to asbestos exposure, and that's either occupational exposure or environmental exposure. So in terms of our progress on getting to an international ban, congratulations on your continued efforts over the last few decades.
I'm really only 25.
You started young. Congratulations for your persistence, and I encourage all of us to support the efforts. Let's make progress on this.
It's long past the time when medical students should be able to read about it in history books and say, oh, well, I don't need to worry about that anymore.
Yep, it's purely preventable and purely possible. Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Lori. Thank you for sharing all your knowledge about this issue with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, creator of Naging Now, a podcast about prioritizing well-being, on the web at neijingnow.org. Naging Now is independent and entirely listener-supported. If you enjoyed the clip, please share it with your friends. Like us on Facebook and donate generously. Your support is essential to keeping Naging Now alive.